here we go. Now, I was talking on Wednesday about Taylor, and this was an attempt to discuss some elements of environmental ethics here. And a concern with Taylor was prompted by the discussion that we had in this classroom last week about environmental problems. And I basically finished on talking about the core beliefs of what's called biocentrism. Let me very quickly review the point about all this. Taylor's book is called Respect for Nature, and he takes this to be an attitude that one has. And one's attitude will condition the way one behaves. Again, the example I gave is if you hate Ford, you'll behave badly toward him and do him down. If you like Bridgestock, you have an attitude of liking for Bridgestock, you'll promote Bridgestock and so on and so forth. Anyway, the respect for nature is an attitude according to Taylor, and he says this attitude is contingent upon what you actually believe. And I think that's probably true. The attitude you have towards something depends upon what you believe about it. So again, if you're René Descartes and you think animals are just machines like your lawnmower, then you'll treat animals any old how. If on the other hand you're a modern animal physiologist or whatever, and you believe animals have similar kinds of responses to stimuli that we do, if you stick a pin in them it'll hurt them, if you have those beliefs, then your attitude toward animals will be different from if you simply believe they are machines. So the point would be, your attitude will depend upon your beliefs. And what Taylor suggests is if you have this attitude of respect for nature, then it could be founded upon these so-called core beliefs that he wants to suggest, are core beliefs of biocentrism. Not anthropocentrism. Anthropocentrism is that humankind, Homo sapiens, members of the species Homo sapiens, are the center, particularly with regard to moral concerns. Biocentrism, on the other hand, suggests that it isn't just human beings that are the center of these moral concerns, the focus of moral concerns, but it's all living things. Bios, living things. And again, I was talking about this last time, and I pointed to particularly to number four. And one of the things I said about number four, that humans are not inherently superior to other living things, that was perhaps the most radical of those particular beliefs there. These beliefs have a factual component, and they also have an evaluative element to them as well. Remember that in my view about theories of morals, you have to have some kind of value specification. And these are four beliefs that Taylor lists. Inherent in these beliefs are elements of value. Four is clearly pretty evaluative, and so is three. One is perhaps a little bit less evaluative, although words like community of life is kind of, well, it looks a little bit of an evaluative term. So four is rather explicitly about value. It's saying that humans are not inherently superior to other living things. And what that means is there's no inherently greater value that attached to human beings than due to other living things. Three is also to some extent evaluative, and I was trying to explain to you what is meant by teleological centers of life, in the sense that each organism, each living thing, is a unique individual pursuing its own good in its own way. I tried to explain what this idea of good meant, and try to contrast, for instance, a nice healthy tree with a pile of old dead wood. We can talk about a tree as being in a better or worse state, in a good or a bad state, but we can't really say the same thing about a pile of wood. We can speak about, some sand. I mean, that doesn't really have a good of its own. But if there are termites or ants living in the sand, we can speak about them having it being in good condition or bad condition and so on. So really, I suppose, with regard to number three, the suggestion is that each organism has some kind of an ideal healthy state to which it aims. To talk about a teleological center talks about something which is goal-oriented and goal-directed. And he wants to suggest, therefore, that three doesn't just encompass human beings, doesn't just encompass mammals, doesn't just encompass vertebrates, but we might also speak about lawns and trees and weeds and Brussels sprout plants and all the rest of it. Now, you might not believe these things. You might think, I don't believe three and I don't believe four. Well, fair enough. If that is your position, then you can either not think about it further, or you might go and read Taylor and see what Taylor has to say. Because one thing about Taylor's book, Respect for Nature, is that he is very careful to try to justify what he says. And in this regard, I think the book is of great interest. I think there are some difficulties with it, but I don't think we should try to sell Taylor short. Again, if we're interested in trying to get some kind of response to the environmental crisis, which is not anthropocentric, but takes account of other things, one might well look at Taylor as a discussable proposition. Now, moral theory has value specifications. It also has action conditions. And I want to suggest to you that we can think of this moral code, as I've called it, of Taylor, as a set of action conditions. And this is new from last time now, and I'll try to explain what these amount to. And again, there are some more or less radical things in this as well. And I did give you a very brief discussion of this. Taylor says rather more than this. There are four principles which talk about how we are supposed to act. And these principles are mainly expressed in terms of certain duties. Now, with regard to duties, you may remember, I hope, that when I talked about rights, I said there was a correlative duty attached to rights. So if somebody has a right, then somebody else, maybe everybody else, has a duty. So if I have a right to own my property, then everybody else has a duty not to interfere with that right, not to interfere with my property. There's a correlative duty. Freedom rights or non-interference rights are contrasted with claim rights. Now, some people talk about this kind of ethics, this non-consequentialism, purely in terms of duty. They don't worry about the rights, the correlative rights. And I've introduced this with regard to rights because I think it's rather easier to think about it in terms of rights than in terms of duties, which are more abstract. However, the normal term for that kind of ethics was deontological, which I can't spell. And deon here, that's the word we want to focus on, just means duty. Now, Taylor's talking about duties, but he's not saying... deontological. I just write things on the board, it's sort of therapy for me. I don't actually want you to be able to read the things. He talks about duties, but he doesn't say there are corresponding rights. Taylor is very careful to say that it's only human beings, according to him, that has rights. Nevertheless, even though something doesn't have a right attached to it, nevertheless, we might have duties with regard to it. Now, again, if you say, well, why do we have the duty, that's much more difficult to answer. If I can say, oh, well, you know, all of these things have rights, that's why I have the duty, that kind of is a little bit more easy to come at. Taylor doesn't do that. He says there are these things called duties, right? Ways of behaving. Now, the first duty that he has in his moral code is not to harm any living thing that has a good of its own. Non maleficence. Don't harm any living thing that has a good of its own. It's a negative duty. It's like a right, a non-interference right. That's the first thing. You might think, boy, if I believe this, I'm going to get awfully hungry by lunchtime. I'll explain a bit more about these after I've gone through them. Non-interference. Keep out of ecosystems, don't stuff them up, don't poison them, don't trap animals, etc. Another negative duty. Now let me go ahead for a second and say this. These duties are not absolute or overriding. which is just as well if you think about it, because if we're not supposed to harm a living thing, what are you going to have for lunch? I mean, we can't eat piles of sand and dead wood. Well, I can't anyway. Or grapes, for instance, that's an important one. The rule of fidelity. Don't deceive animals, don't break its trust, don't trap it, don't fish for it, etc. Number two, non-interference, is based upon the idea of allowing a teleological center to develop its good. Leave it alone, let it develop, let it realize its good. Don't cut it down, don't fish for it, don't trap it, and so on. He thinks we should have a specific fidelity part of the moral code, just because there are so many specific ways that you can interfere with living things. So I'm afraid that if you like recreational fishing, it's not on, because fish are teleological centers which have goods of their own. And if you believe this moral code, if you have the biocentric outlook, you're not supposed to go recreational fishing because you're messing about with the fish. Similarly with hunting and trapping. In deceiving the animals, he gives the example of the chap, the duck hunter with the duck caller, goes like that, and the duck thinks, oh yeah, other ducks, and he flaps over and gets shot. I mean, that's a little bit sort of mundane, I suppose. 1 to 3 are negative duties. They tell us not to do certain things. And this is very much the position that Taylor wants to put forward. You're leaving wild nature to go on its own. And again, this moral code is primarily applying to wild nature. It's not entirely clear, as far as I can see from his book, what his position is with regard to domestic animals. It's just not entirely clear, to me anyway, exactly what his position is with regard to domesticated things. But this is primarily with regard to wild nature. And his basic view is, as far as possible, let it develop on its own and keep out of the way. Don't mess about with wild nature. Leave it alone. If we've messed about with wild nature, however, and if we've, so to speak, not accepted the negative duties in 1, 2, and 3, then we're under some obligation to restore the balance. Restitutive justice means restore the balance of nature when any of, I should say, not on, I'm sorry, 1 to 3 have been violated. So when you've done an injustice to nature, then what Taylor is saying is that you should make restitution by trying to restore the balance in some kind of way. Well, perhaps you're right, yes, perhaps you're right. If it would be restitution which should be made for some considerable time back from the time of domesticated animals, which is quite, well, I guess, I think you're probably right. Yes, that's a good point to make. Now, I'd like to read one point of further clarification here, which is a fairly kind of important one. He really has a, as I said, a very strong view about non-interference, and he thinks that even if it's the case that some species is going to become extinct naturally, you let that happen. So let me read a passage from Taylor, maybe get some flavour of what these non-interference principles involve. And I read, in one sense, to have the attitude of respect toward natural ecosystems, toward wild living things, and toward the whole process of evolution, is to believe that nothing goes wrong in nature. Even the extinction of an entire biotic community, or the extinction of a species, is not evidence that something is amiss. If the causes of such events arose within the system of nature itself, nothing improper has happened. In particular, the fact that organisms suffer and die does not itself call for corrective action on the part of humans, when humans have had nothing to do with the cause of that suffering and death. And that last bit is in italics. So restitution would not apply when humans have not done it. But if humans have done it, restitution should.
Okay. What if you have an animal which, for all likeliness is going extinct naturally, but that process has been rapidly sped up by humans. So therefore, you're not giving the ecosystems time to recover to its extinction.
Yeah, sure. Look, I mean, do we have an example?
And to further confuse it, if you take the stance that you have to restore the damage that humans have done, what if you then impede on the first three principles of the you do interfere with the ecosystem?
Yes, well, were Paul Taylor here, he might be able to answer it. I think what he would say, and he does say, is that this moral code is pretty general in outline. And the next bit I'm going to get onto is what you do when there are competing priorities and what you try, and he has some principles for trying to resolve them. But yeah, look, I mean, I think it's difficult to come to conclusions about what to do on the basis of those four. I mean, but you can ask the question. I mean, suppose a species is dying out, and we've got nothing to do with it. Should we save it? And some people would certainly say yes. I mean, I guess some animal rights people. You see, this is not an animal rights view as such. It's rather different from that. It's a rights for the whole of the biosphere. And the idea that nature knows best, I mean, is an interesting kind of evaluative principle. I mean, why should we assume that nature knows best? I mean, a perfectly natural event might be a meteor heading toward Earth. I mean, what are we supposed to do then? Are we supposed to build a spaceship? What are we supposed to say here? Say, nature knows best. What do you think, Eileen? You got to... He does have some things to say about that, and he does have some things to say about retreating back from, of trying to give stuff back to the natural environment. But, you know, I agree with both of the two comments. I think you're making a similar one to Matt, is that we seem to have interfered to such an extent with the ecosystem that really what exactly does form mean? I mean, maybe just about, if you take the McKibben view, that there's no nature left at all, that everywhere on the planet there are marks of human activity, then what exactly is this restitution program going to involve? You know, complete withdrawal from... I was going to say this next time, but I'll say it now, and I might say it next time as well. We're allowed in here to discuss ideas. We're not, fortunately, in the Premier's department or in the Prime Minister's department having to make policy. We're not at the Berlin Conference on Global Emissions and so on. So we're allowed to discuss ideas in here. You see, and if
right, it's very...
here we go again. I put in some new batteries. Anyway, the problem I think is the suggestion that somehow you can find value in nature, and this is called the view that value is objective value. Nature knows best. We shouldn't interfere with nature. To speak of nature knowing best, you're somehow finding value in nature. And this goes against a tradition about value. The tradition about value says values only come into existence with valuers, and we are the only valuers. There was no value in the world before Homo sapiens came along, because Homo sapiens are the ones that attribute value. Now, I think that if a philosopher wanted to try to attack Taylor, that would be one of the ways it would be done. Now, if that's true, if it's true that all value is subjective and not objective, it still doesn't follow that the other things Taylor says are wrong, but it makes them kind of unlikely. I mean, why, if we are the source of value, would we hold that we are not inherently superior to mosquitoes and Brussels sprouts? It seems a bit odd to try to get us to believe, I am not really inherently any better than that weed down there, which is alive. I mean, if my species is the source of all value, it seems odd that I would come to believe that. So I guess if we had to kind of start chipping away at Taylor, and I'm not in the business of doing that, because I want to put forward Taylor's views as something for you to think about. You know, it's up to you whether you want to accept it or not, really. I mean, I really would prefer not to dispose you one way or the other. I'd like you to think about this view. But if one had to start chipping away at it, this would be one way a philosopher would tend to do it. It's a funny kind of view about value. Having said that, a lot of these radical responses, like Taylor and like deep ecology we're going to talk about next time, do suggest that we have to change the way we think about ethics and morality and value as well. In fact, the deep ecologists I'm going to talk about next time also see value in nature. They also think, well, ecosystems in and of themselves are valuable, not just for what they're good for us. So the debate then becomes, at a very fundamental level of just sort of philosophical foundation of the debate, become quite contentious. Is there really value in nature? Or is it just human beings that do the valuing? I mean, that's kind of a basic sort of question. I think that not only is it a basic question, it's something that scientific knowledge has an answer about too. I think science says there's no value in nature, there's only value in human beings. It says it for a couple of reasons. And I think we'll get onto it in one respect when we talk about evolutionary ethics. So if you wanted to think about this, again, I mean, maybe think about it in these sorts of terms. Do we like the beliefs? Do they give rise to respect for nature, do you think? Do they give a moral code? Yes? No? What about the conflict resolution scheme? Is that going to work?